And welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 18th of August 2009. Should be an interesting show. We're going to have Geoffrey Green. He's just been reappointed President of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. That should be very eventful a few months as the left-wing Labor government winds back the very modest reforms of the previous government, and that is causing considerable outrage right across the country, not just amongst fathers groups, amongst many ordinary people who were led to believe or thought that the family law problems which have plagued this country for decades had been solved. So we'll be talking to him shortly. We'll also have Geoffrey Asher, who is a leading... he ran the only men's studies course in Canada for many years until the women's studies group on campus, you know, always open to tolerance and diversity and all that sort of thing, shut him down. So he will be also a very interesting talker and a lecturer of quite some note, and quite an intellectual man and a very impressive man. So that should also be very interesting. First up, the very blessed, that most loved of organisations in Australia, the Child Support Agency, has a new manager.
Right, straight off the press here, from the Child Support Agency, they have just announced that they have appointed a new deputy secretary slash general manager. Miss Philippa Goodwin is due to commence on the 7th of September. Further information will be available closer to that date. Miss Philippa Goodwin will take up the position and as Deputy Secretary of Child Support and Planning. Ms. Goodwin brings significant service delivery and policy experience to her new role. She has been Acting Chief Executive Officer at Medicare Australia since November 2008. There she is. She's taking Matt Miller's place.
Well, as we all know, the very first child support agencies were created by the Bolsheviks as part of their war on the nuclear family. They were created in Australia to bolster the mother custody models that the family court was so fond of. We have one major question from Ms. Villipa. How many of your clients are going to die under your reign? Thousands and thousands of dads died under Matt Miller's reign. More than 7,000 clients of the Child Support Agency, we estimate, and from Freedom of Information, have died since Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister. This organisation is a disgrace. It does far, far, far more harm than good in this country. It destroys many otherwise perfectly equitable breakups are destroyed by this disgusting agency, and we want to know how many of deaths are you going to ignore? Matt Miller ignored hundreds of thousands of people's deaths and wandered off with his massive salary happily into the future. Well, here we go again. How much more is the Australian people going to put up with this rubbish? It really is rubbish. If you can possibly avoid that agency, do so.
It really is rubbish. You know, when you're talking about the amount of money that's poured into the government for funding of road accidents and black spots and you know, trying to reduce the national road toll, and then you look at the toll that's attributed directly to clients that go through the Child Support Agency, that toll is larger than our national road toll. But yet nothing is said, nothing gets spent, and no one does any studies on it.
No one. The Edith Cowan University in Western Australia is the only people that have done any decent studies of the impacts of the Child Support Agency, and they're absolutely scathing on its impacts, as we've had some of those academics on. Just a related story, which is quite interesting. This is out of America. A childless man has been released from child support debt, and this sort of rubbish goes on in Australia all the time, where people are having their houses sold from under them and absolutely farcical decisions made by officers, you know, year out of university and women's studies courses, and all men are bastards. Frank Hatley, 50, spent 13 months in jail for being a deadbeat dad before his release last month. A judge ordered him jailed in June 2008 for failing to support his son, a child who DNA tests proved was not fathered by Hatley. And don't think there are a lot of people in this country who are not campaigning to introduce jail sentences for dads who fall behind in child support here in Australia. Last week, Cook County Superior Court Judge Dane Pepkins signed an order stating defendant is no longer responsible for paying any amount of child support. The order permits the state's Office of Child Support Services to close its file on Hatley. We're satisfied with the result for Mr. Hatley, but still troubled by the state's monumental lapse of judgment in this case. Attorney Garatley with the Atlanta-based Southern Centre for Human Rights told CNN in a written statement, and I don't think that these things are not human rights issues, because they most certainly are, and the human rights abuses perpetuated by the Child Support Agency every single day of the week, including this week, are absolutely scandalous. It's an absolutely mal-managed, dysfunctional agency that should have been shut down under any normal review many years ago. Hatley did not immediately return a call from CNN, but his story of the bloke dates back to 86, when Hatley had a relationship with an Esley Monsoon who gave birth to a son and claimed it was his, which of course it wasn't. And as we all know, many kids born in Australia are not the biological children of the person that is claimed to be the father. Well, that's enough vitriol in the Child Support Agency. We wouldn't be dads on the air if we didn't have a shot at the Child Support Agency.
Indeed.
And, oh, my God, they deserve it.
They do.
They really do. But anyway, they're so dishonest. That's what amazes me. The review officers are just a pack of liars. They're just unbelievable.
Well, you know, what concerns me is that, you know, you bring up this stuff about, you know, the suicide rate and how many people leave the child support through suicide to the management. And they just say, oh, well, we don't have the capability to look at that.
Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, yes, they do, yes.
Yeah. You cannot stop paying child support without the reason for it being registered. If you ask the policy division, they'll say we don't keep those statistics. Right. But you ask the IT people, they keep those statistics. They have to. They're obligated to.
Yeah, so it's not that they don't have the capability. It's just that, you know.
We've long called on them to publish their death statistics on a monthly basis.
They don't have the heart.
They don't have the guts.
They don't want to face it.
Mm. Anyway, that's enough vitriol on the Child Support Agency. We have a much more moderate and sensible person on the line in terms of Geoffrey Green. Are you there, Geoffrey?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
All right. Now, look, you've just been appointed, I gather, as President of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia.
Yes, John, I'm delighted to be back in the role. It's a challenging time going forward. Having founded the SPCA nearly 8 years ago, we've done a terrific job, and the organisation under its previous administration has done a fantastic job as well. And it's a very worthwhile organisation. I'm pleased to be able to head it up again in these times as we're moving forward with potential threats to the outcomes for our families going forward.
Well, there's nothing potential about them. They're really very strong and very real and very likely to come about, I would have thought.
Well, we're yet to see that. There's a few inquiries concurrently going on.
You have a judge like Richard Chisholm, who is notorious for his feminist bias. I mean, what do you think's going to happen?
Well, I wouldn't want to preempt the findings of these reports. Our evidence and the fact since the reforms of 2006 is that family law has been far better handled than it was ever previously. And I actually suspect that both the AIFS and the Chisholm report are going to find that. And whilst they'll be looking to tweak things around the around the edges, I don't expect that they're going to come out with wholesale changes. But if they do, they'll be vigorously opposed, not just by the Shared Parenting Council, but by the Australian people. Australian people are very happy with the current circumstances in relation to family law. Those improvements in 2006, whilst not everything they were, certainly a vast improvement on the previous structure and the previous regime. And I can't imagine the Australian public wanting to go back to the future.
No, I mean, well, as you know, we here have always editorialised that the changes did not go far enough, that the family relationship centres should have been shared parenting centres, and that genuinely help people to accommodate themselves into shared parenting arrangements at very difficult and often hostile periods of their life, and that it left far too much decision-making in the power of family court judges. But nonetheless, there has been a significant cultural shift, hasn't there?
Yes, there has, and that's a good thing, and it was well overdue. I mean, with this fundamental structural reform, including the establishment of the family relations centres, I mean, we need to expect that there's going to be a teething problem here or there in relation to those matters. That doesn't mean there's any legislative problem, and I don't think that there's been any evidence to to support that there's anything wrong with the legislation. Whilst there may be some education issues and some resourcing issues and some, you know, capacities of the qualifications of the people engaged in this process, I don't think that's any issue to do with the legislative reform. I think the legislative reform has yet to be shown to be deficient in any way, and that's really the key aspect that we'll be looking at from the Shared Parenting Council's point of view.
We always thought that the default position should be shared parenting and that there should be really very little variation from that except under extreme circumstances. But that's not quite the case of the legislation, is it?
Not really. It's not that far off that aspect, though. I mean, what we really need to look at is the, you know, the overall majority of matters and what category they fall into versus the very rare and very small quantity of matters that have very difficult, you know, violence backgrounds or in difficult circumstances. Now, in the overall majority of cases where both parents have been found to be fit parents, and of course most parents were found to be fit parents prior to their separation, so the aspect of them not being fit all of a sudden because of a divorce or separation, you know, defies logic. So in those cases where they have been found to be fit parents, well then the courts are required to consider equal time as the first parenting arrangements thereafter. Now, of course, other circumstances come into to those aspects, including the capacity of the parents to deal with those circumstances. And this is where, you know, flexibility is there in the system. But it is a requirement where there's shared parental responsibility that they consider, the courts consider shared and equal parenting time. Now, that doesn't have to be a strictly 50-50 arrangement to be a shared arrangement, but, you know, that's the starting point, and that's what we believe was the fundamental aspects of the law reform that we sought prior to that legislative reform, and that's what that legislative reform is all about.
And it has, to some degree, brought about some change, hasn't it? I mean, I forget the exact statistics on the last number of shared parenting orders that Family Court was making, but it was in the sort of teens. I think it wasn't over 20% from memory. But that is a significant shift upwards, I guess.
Fundamentally, there has been an improvement in shared parenting outcomes, whilst they're not, you know, huge numbers yet. It's still very early days. I mean, the cultural change that the legislation from 2006 brought in is going to take some time to filter through the system, and I expect years. I think really the first point of review is, other than any, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's that need to be looked at, which we're yet to be convinced that there are any, but if there are, we're happy to look and consult with government about that. But, I mean, going forward, I expect it will be some years before we're in a position to really evaluate the value and the benefit to society from the reforms. They are worldwide recognised as leading family law reforms. Israel, in fact, introduced the Australian version of family law almost lock, stock and barrel as a direct copy of our system because they looked at it and couldn't fault it. And that's now working very well over there. Canada, of course, is still looking to move that way as well. And I think that you'll find that the reforms that were brought in here under the Howard government in Australia will start to permeate around the world. Can't see there's any logical reason or any prospect of a return to the bad old days.
You're an optimist, mate. I see.
Well, the Australian public wouldn't tolerate it.
We've seen very well publicised demonstrations outside courts of a particularly ragged group of women claiming that the laws are forcing people into relationships with abusive dads, always abusive dads, of course. What do you say to those demonstrators and to the people that have noticed those news stories and perceived that, well, maybe there is an issue here?
Well, you know, that there's some people who aren't happy with the fact that they no longer have total control over the circumstances. Well, so be it. You know, that's no ground or basis for changing what are, you know, rather modest and sensible reforms that were introduced a few years ago. What is a better outcome or better determinant is the societal impact of these circumstances and of the new arrangements, and the societal impact of the new arrangements are all positive. So, and there's no evidence to support any contrary view, or certainly none that's been presented.
Well, certainly the Chief Justice, Diana Bryant, and advocates of the old regime, like Richard Chisholm, have seen many problems, and they claim that one of those great problems is the expectations of fathers, and that fathers now expect to be able to care for their children after divorce and to have a good relationship with their children after divorce, and that the expectations of those men is one of the difficulties within the current system. What do you say to that?
Well, those expectations are realistic expectations. It was the previous expectations that were the abhorrent circumstance. It is appropriate that both parents, mothers and fathers, can expect to have a significant parenting role in the upbringing of their children post-separation. They had one before separation. Why can't they expect to have it after separation? So that's a legitimately held view by the majority of parents and in fathers. You know, that itself is no basis. I mean, that's just sort of holding on to the past.
I think one of the most evil bits of nonsense peddled by the opponents to it is the primary carer thing, which is very similar to the terra nullis idea that, you know, Australia was uninhabited before we arrived, before the white guys arrived, and the whole primary carer thing. Most modern families now, dad and mum pretty well share the care and the work and everything else all together, don't they?
Well, they do, and it's actually not just about that aspect in any event. It's children's capacity and desire to be loved and share that the guidance from both their parents. It's not just about, you know, who does the washing up or who does mows the lawn or what value you put to washing the clothes versus, you know, putting the garbage out. I mean, those sorts of, you know, internal domestic affairs aren't relative to the care and love and guidance of the upbringing of a child. You know, a child is entitled to share in the wisdom and benefit of the experience of both their parents equally. There's no differentiation on, you know, which aspect of parenting has more value than another aspect of parenting. So, you know, I mean, again, this is all, you know, straw men arguments. I think, you know, the fundamental argument that I saw from the Chief Justice in relation to why reform was needed was a furphy argument on the basis that there was a lower filing of violence applications or seeking, you know, state intervention in violence applications. You know, that's exactly what
expect.
We said would happen.
Yeah.
Once those provisions, you know, putting a limited, modest amount of security over false allegations was introduced, we expected there would be a decrease of those sorts of applications, and there have. So if anything, that whole argument proves that the legislation has been working, not the contrary.
And there's been a significant amount of outrage about the Chief Justice speaking out, claiming that women are now being penalised for raising allegations of violence. Do you have a view on that?
No, I don't. Look, again, that's a furphy straw man argument. If there is a circumstances and legitimate circumstances where there's a risk to children, any right-minded parent will raise that issue if it's genuine and it's legitimately held, and any court will hear that application.
It should have been held long before you got to the family court. It's a police matter, surely.
Yeah, well, it either is or isn't. I mean, if there's a risk there, there's a risk there. Whether they're separated or not separated, there's a risk to a child, there's a risk to a child, and those matters should be brought up when dealt with. So, you know, in the context of a separation or divorce situation, for it to all of a sudden occur there, the legitimacy of that needs to be established. And the best person to establish that is a judge. I mean,
I would not agree with that. I'm sorry. I wouldn't have thought a judge in a family court was the last person on earth that would make a sensible decision about those sorts of allegations.
Well, they're the people who hear the evidence. And because they haven't been finding in the way that some of these protesting women groups find, we've got this push for legislative reform. So, I mean, that is anecdotally telling you that the courts are doing a reasonably good job in this area. And I think whilst there may be, you know, a judge here or there that perhaps doesn't have the right perspective, I think overall they're the best person to assess the evidence in such a circumstance. And there's no case that we're aware of where a fine or a cost order has been brought against a parent other than in a circumstance where the court found that the claim made was not reasonably held. It's the same as if anybody went to the police and accused somebody of a criminal offence, and if that wasn't a legitimately held complaint made, then that person would quite likely suffer a charge of false pretense.
So what you're saying? We'll go to a quick break shortly, but what you're saying is that this legislation, the new legislation, has, you know, the family court was always known as the palace of lies, and it was an adversarial system. It was just routine for parents to fling mud at each other. They were encouraged to do so by the lawyers and by the system itself. You're saying that this legislation has helped to defuse that whole terrible situation.
No, I think it has, and it's also helped to establish some certainty for parents that and to remove some of the fear that they're not going to lose the relationships they have with their children, and that's the fundamental basis of why this reform is good. Once the disputation between who's going to see the children, it's a winner-take-all scenario under the old regime. Now it's everybody wins the prize under the new regime. That's part of the thing of reducing the temperature and the conflict of divorce.
That brings up the whole resistance of the bureaucracy to these changes, because of course the greatest money spinner and the greatest justification for bureaucracy empire building has been the creation of the social artifact, the single mum. But anyway, we're going to a quick song and we'll be back. We're talking with Geoffrey Green. He's the newly appointed president of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia and a significant player in family law reform in Australia. We'll be back in a moment.
have my children near? Do they think that I can take it? Do they think it doesn't matter? Do they think that because I'm a man that somehow won't shatter?
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And we're talking with Geoffrey Green. He's the newly appointed federal president of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. Are you there, Geoffrey?
Yes.
Look, I think it's worth just taking people back to the dark old days for a minute when you first came along and got interested in family law reform in, it must be a good 10 years ago, is it? It's quite some years ago now. Can you just talk about what it was like and what was driving the need for reform?
Look, I think family law is one of those aspects of society that touches everybody, if not directly through a family member or a close friend. There's not anybody in Australia who doesn't know somebody who's either been a part of a family law decision or knows somebody who's been adversely impacted or impacted in some way by family law. So it's a pervasive kind of legislative arrangement. Now, is that a good thing? Probably not. But it seems to be an unavoidable fact of history in Australia. What was happening at the time I got engaged, and of course there were many trailblazers prior to my engagement in the issue, where the family court was essentially the place that separating or divorcing parents would end up. Both parents would walk into the family court with children. One of them would walk out of the family court without them. And that was a standard regime outcome whereby the old sort of formula-driven every second weekend contact for a father with children, which in most cases within 12 months ended up in probably up to 50% of cases of very little or no contact with their children. So
I understand that stats, at least 50% or higher than 50% of fathers saw their children once a year or less.
It became an emotional roller coaster for not just the fathers in those circumstances or the parents who lost out of in the custody battle, as it was called, but it's a huge loss for the children. Your children, you know, love and respect and treat their parents equally, and they don't want to be brought up in these circumstances where one of their major and fundamental relationships is severed by a decree of a government institution, and that's what was occurring back before these reforms. That old regime was just a disaster for societal circumstances in cases where parents separated or divorced.
Is part of this because of the history of the institution itself? I mean, it always had very staunch left-wing judges. Elizabeth Evatt was a renowned left-winger, and Justice Nicholson, of course, was another failed ALP candidate and renowned left-winger. So it had always had a very strong left-wing bias right from the very top of it. Do you think that's one of the reasons why it was so hostile to fathers, the so-called patriarchs?
Well, it never in its initial incarnation, fulfilled the objective that it was supposed to achieve.
A friendly helping court.
Lionel Murphy, whose dream for the family court was to get people out of litigious circumstances like it used to be handled by state supreme courts, and to get them out of that scenario into, as you said, a family-friendly helping court. That never fulfilled its objective, and in fact wasn't very long after its establishment back in 1975. Where the High Court ruled that, no, this is the court, it has to act like a court and has to have the same rules and procedures of any court, and all of a sudden its sort of premise for being was essentially curtailed by the processes of High Court appeals of how it should operate. And from that point on, I think it's been, it's struggled. Now, there have been many attempts to reform the family court. There was the Peter Duncan reforms in 1995, and his speech to Parliament was very clear that these reforms were to bring in an era of shared parenting. That's what his speech was, but regrettably the legislation itself and or the implementation of the legislation failed to achieve that outcome. And so here we were 10 years after that reform, which was supposed to achieve shared parenting outcomes.
And if you look back at the history, stuff like the Australian Law Reform Commission held a major inquiry into the federal justice system under the auspices of the Howard government, and they did the most extensive, to this date, the most extensive survey of the family court and of litigants and lawyers, and they found overwhelming disquiet, quote unquote, both from litigants and lawyers over the court. Absolutely overwhelming disquiet with what was going on in there.
I'd have to say there weren't too many supporters of the family court and the way it operated. And when you think of the practical outcomes of separating children from one of their parents, why would anyone be happy with that? I mean, the children are never going to be happy with it. One of the parents is never going to be happy with it. And quite frankly, the other parent...
booby prize, a kid that they had to look after 24/7. I mean,
well, that's right.
That's hard work. Who needs it?
That's right. And, in the end, the relationships between the children and that parent who, you know, there were often circumstances of those children growing up resenting that parent from cutting the other parent out of their lives. So no one won. Nobody won, except the lawyers, of course, because it was a heated battle. I mean, this is the other thing aspect of that sort of regime that was in place, and it was horrific, was the costs imposed upon parties who all they wanted was an arrangement to continue to have a relationship with their children, but they would be pitched warfare, winner-takes-all circumstances. In they'd go, lawyers, money, child psychologists, family reports.
And that saddest side of all, the dad clutching the big folder of legal documents, making a beeline for his local politician, you know.
Well, that was a resultant outcome. Family law was one of the biggest issues that a member of parliament had to deal with through the constituents coming to them with, you know, problem after problem after problem. It was a horrific circumstance and a horrific situation, and the family court had no support. It was, you know, I think the most telling aspect of the confidence that the legislature branch, the parliament, had in the family court was is when they finally did this inquiry that commenced in 2003 when John Howard announced it at Question Time one fateful day in July 2003. When that inquiry wrapped up, it was one of the largest amounts of submissions ever given to a government parliamentary inquiry from the public. They did a series of public interviews and public hearings all around the country. And they were hearing the same thing over and over and over again. And when they finally determined their report, the committee, which consisted of both Labor and Liberal members of Parliament, and it was a unanimous report of that committee, essentially determined that the family court had no capacity to survive and it should be abolished and replaced with with a family tribunal. That's what the parliamentarians thought of the structures of the family court and the culture of the family court.
Why, in the end, was the family court not abolished if so many people still believe it should be?
Well, look, I think, political reform is always incremental. You know, I think that in the end, on balance, the Federal Magistrates Court had been set up, which we fully supported and thought that was a, you know, one great first step in the process. There were issues of law, there were issues of financial arrangements and property settlements that also still had to be taken into account. It wasn't just the issues to do with children. So there's a sort of wide aspects and a very all-encompassing sort of reach of family law issues. And in the end, it was determined that fast-tracking the Magistrates Court, giving it the capacity to deal with most of these cases, fundamentally reforming the law, but allowing the family court to exist to do what we would call the more entrenched or difficult cases and or appeals, was the fundamental basis of going forward. The family tribunal aspect of it was reconstituted into what they call family relationship centres, which are still in the process of being established. I don't believe all of them have been established yet, or if they have, they're not.
And there's very mixed reports, I'd have to say, coming out of them, because they're staffed often by anti-shared parenting advocates like Relationships Australia. So, I mean, they've got their own problems.
Well, you know, all systems have had problems in the past. I guess it's which one's got the least problems over the previous system. And I think that, you know, I'm not saying that these things are in any way perfect and no one's claiming that. I think they're an improvement. They've got a capacity to continue to evolve and develop once people settle down and understand that the legislative reforms in place are in place and they need to be enacted and they're in the best interests of children. Once we start putting the fact that what we're really about is what's in the best interests of children, and all of the research supports that shared parental arrangements are in the best interests of children, there's nothing disputing that anywhere in the world, no credible research disputing that. So we need to get on with it, and we need to continue to reform these processes to, you know, and education processes and qualification assessments, all those sorts of aspects of the people who operate in this very sensitive and emotional area of life.
There is a posting just gone up on the Family Law Web Guide recently, which does illustrate some of the problems that still exist in these family relationship centres. If you don't mind, I'll just read a couple of paragraphs of this, because I think this is an issue which is really holding back the whole reform towards shared parenting in Australia. And this guy writes, and he's just had his final hearing and so on, we won't say his name or his kids' names or anything, but he says, "I don't know whether my situation is the norm or not, but we separated very amicably. There was never any violence nor any threat of violence, and there never will be. There were no police, no AVOs, no scratches, no questionable injuries, no threatening letters or emails or texts, nothing. And yet, during proceedings, I remember thinking how much the mother had been betrayed by the group. She went and joined a domestic violence group that purported to support her, yet was simply exploiting a vulnerable but complicit woman to promote their own self-fulfilling agenda. To this day, I still believe that if the mother was properly encouraged to cooperate from the outset, we would not have ended up in court, and the damaging events that occurred in the midst of court, including to our child, would not be part of our baggage today. But it's not only this anti-domestic violence group that encouraged the mother into a fervor of anti-father, anti-shared care hysteria. I was in fact left mortified at the buy-in of so many family law support institutions to this notion that I, as a separated father, must unquestionably be a villain. This included a family relationship centre family advisor who convinced the mother not to negotiate any shared care with me, quote, because it's bad for the kids, and amongst others, the independent children's lawyer who stated that she would never agree to the child having any overnight time with me because it's, quote, just not healthy for a six-year-old child be away from his mother," end quote, "and because it would reduce the mother's child support," end quote. Now, a lot of this nonsense that we've seen for decades is still going on, or so it would appear from that particular epistle.
Well, it just goes to show how far we've got to go. You know, the legislative reform were really first steps. The cultural change is yet to take hold, and that's why I think I was saying earlier, you know, we're going to be, you know, 5-10 years before, you know, we're in a position to have a look back and see whether we've, you know, gone far enough or whether the reforms have actually achieved anything. But this is sort of substantial resistance and holding on to the regime of the past and trying to bring that mode of thinking into these current arrangements. And ultimately that can't succeed, and we can't let it succeed, because that is what is an outrageous circumstance occurring. And it's not uncommon. I'm not quite questioning that it's, this is
actually part of that story, though, was that the magistrate was right on his side and was encouraging him to go for 50-50 all the time. The magistrate was right on the dad's side and could see the nonsense that was being perpetrated against him. So that in itself was interesting.
It gets very disappointing when you've got, effectively children's representatives, children's lawyers, engaging in this sort of conduct on outdated methodology and outdated, sociological outcomes. I mean, so the whole thing is just very frightening. And I think this is going to take some time to weed out of the system. This is more, if you ever wanted evidence of why, organisations such as the Shared Parenting Council need to exist, this is one great, underlining of that.
Well, I think we could have another whole interview on the failure to reform the family law reports, for instance, on which a lot of custody decisions are made, on the behaviour of child representatives, which is also an outrage. I think we're going to have to leave it there for today, and we'll get you back either next week or the week after, if you don't mind.
Most welcome, John, any time.
We've been talking with Geoffrey Green. He's the newly appointed president of Shared Parenting Council of Australia and a great figure in the fight for family law reform in Australia. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Jeffrey Asher, all the way from Canada. You there, Jeffrey?
Yes, I am. Good to see you, Kendra.
I think we only just caught a taste of you a couple of weeks ago at the end of the show that we did on the Canadian special, so I think we'll reintroduce you, really. You ran the only men's study course in Canada. Can you just talk a bit about what that was and just explain to our listeners what that was all about?
Well, first of all, I don't think that studies according to sex are legitimate. I was teaching a course about sociology. I don't think women's studies are any more legitimate than men's studies. What I was teaching about was epidemiology and statistics to show primarily that women's claims of disadvantage were just not true and that differences within the sexes were based on biology and these biological differences were impossible to change and therefore, and up until the middle of the 20th century or until the feminist revolution of the 1970s, society adjusted to these differences between women and men and, for the most part, worked well. When women started demanding quotas or feminists started demanding quotas, and feminists don't represent women, that's what turned society really almost upside down and caused quotas to become more important than merit. And that's no way to build any democratic society. What feminism did fundamentally was to attack equality before the law, equality of opportunity, and try to replace that with set quotas. Now, the word they use is equality. What they really mean is 50%, and that's a quota.
And there's been a very long march, hasn't there, through the institutions, particularly the universities, of these sorts of ideologies or philosophies?
Certainly has, and the problem is that the universities encourage them, as do, by the way, the media and the judiciary. Given those three together, feminist jurisprudence has just about dominated every Western society, and as you know, to the great detriment of the family, leading to heightened divorce rates, and rarely does a father gain residential custody of a child. Now, I am one of those rarer fathers who was granted custody of my daughter in a divorce, but I realize that, again, I'm rare. Over 40% of marriages in Canada end in divorce. If a man marries a university graduate woman, the divorce rate is above 50%. Less than 6% of Canadian fathers are granted residential custody by the courts. Although I was one of them, that only heightens the rarity. The remaining 94% non-custodial fathers, as you well know, are reduced to wallets and weekend visitors with their children who they love about all else. What I'm interested in tonight, John, is how to prevent this. Although you do wonderful work on your program, and I wish we had a program like yours in Canada, in dealing with the crises of divorce, it would be better if they didn't happen, or if they not didn't happen at all, or if they happened much less. Now, the question is, how can men avoid these, particularly young men? And one of the questions I should ask right away is, should men marry? Because once you get to enter into a marriage contract, feminist jurisprudence enters and the courts. Every married man knows he's one argument away from seeing his children only on the weekends. As a researcher observed, you never really know who your wife is until she divorces you. The next question we should ask is, instead of marrying, should men maintain relationships with women only as long as both are satisfied and then end them? And here's the toughest question. Should men conceive children? Of course we love our children. Bringing up a child was the most rewarding event of my life. But you can't be rewarding if you only see your children on weekends under highly restrictive conditions and those children's love for you is poisoned by parental alienation. Question worth asking is whether men should have vasectomies. After my horrors in going through the divorce mill and feminist jurisprudence, that's what I decided on, a vasectomy. And in the five following years after my vasectomy, three women accused me of making them pregnant and demanded support payments. I told them to sue. None of them did.
Oh, dear. That was smart.
I really enjoyed it. I insisted all three of them bring a friend along so we could discuss it.
Yes. And?
Anyways, repeated studies show that from, and here's something else that's disturbing. Repeated studies show that from 10% to 30% of children within marriages were conceived by a man who is not his wife's legal partner. In other words, not the nominal father. If a man's father or wife delivers a child, should he routinely request a DNA fatherhood test? It's a good question to ask. Now, what, if any, are the conditions that might permit a man to marry and raise children in a stable and long-lasting marriage? Well, we know that 2/3 to 80% of divorces are initiated by wives, and it's not because of neglect, abuse, or violence, as admitted by the wives themselves. They tend to say that they're not satisfied. For not being emotionally satisfied, they're willing to break up a family because they know that divorce is almost a sure thing, that they will get custody of children and the house and income almost automatically granted by the courts. Men are much more willing to solve problems, live with them, and feel that marriage is for life. Now, what are the factors that would lead to choosing a woman who's less likely to divorce? Now, you know these things already, and your audience probably knows them too, but I'm going to say them anyhow, no matter how silly they may seem.
Right.
First
ahead.
Of all, avoid pretty, sexy women. That's not the woman to be your wife. They know they are pretty.
Yeah.
They see hundreds of men stare at them every day.
Yeah, they're absolutely gorgeous, some of them. And we have Bondi Beach here in Sydney, which is known as the place where there are more gorgeous women per square metre than anywhere else on the planet.
Australia's renowned worldwide for the beautiful women. And by the way, if you want to see the power of a beautiful woman, walk down the main street of a city during lunch hour when the women who are working in offices are out on the sidewalk. Pick a pretty woman and walk behind her about 10 feet. Don't watch her. Watch the eyes of the men approaching her. And you will see what the power of a pretty woman is like.
Oh, yes,
and she sees that every day, again and again and again.
Yeah.
Pick a woman with obvious attraction faults. And, you know, this may sound odd to you, but I assure you, she will be grateful for your attention. She'll be grateful for your loyalty and affection. And, by the way, I promise you, as her personal and emotional qualities improve, she's going to get prettier in your eyes. However, she may not get prettier in the eyes of every other man, which is not what you want. See if she gets along well with her father. Better still, see if she respects her father. That's a good indicator that she'll get along with her in marriage. If she has older brothers, see if she treats them well. If her parents remain married until middle age, that's a good sign, too. Now, you're not going to like this, but a lot of sexual partners before marriage is not a link to a lasting marriage. This applies to the men as well as the women. No bragging about previous partners. People who are committed to marriage tend to look at sex being rewarding within that marriage, period. Of course, this advice occurs almost everywhere. Compliment her, flatter her, provide affection and gifts, often, especially an anniversary, her birthday, any day she considers important, and do all this for no reason at all. If she wants to argue and shout, let her. Listen for the core of her complaints. Accept her personality. You're not going to change her on that, and she won't change. If you can do it without humiliation, give in to her demands. Generally, try to retain her respect for you. Try to continue to earn respect of her and your children. To be blunt, men and women do not have the same rational or moral expectations about life or family. Men have to adjust to that. Another way to prevent the divorce is to protect your assets, including your home, your income, and savings from seizure. It's best to talk to an accountant about this, or even talk to a divorce lawyer before you're even married. They may give you very good advice on how to protect your assets. Other factors that make a woman more likely to divorce, if she's below age 24 at marriage. The younger she is at marriage, more likely she is to divorce. If she's got education beyond college, I'm sorry, guys, but this is bad news. University-educated women are likely to divorce above 50% of all marriages. Almost all are indoctrinated with feminism. Another piece of bad news is living together before marriage does not lead to a long marriage. people who don't live together before marriage are more likely to get married and stay married. If her parents are divorced, that's not good. If they're divorced many times, even worse. If she's been divorced, she may divorce again. If she's been divorced more than once, avoid her. It may seem that women after a divorce who don't have enough income or resources to take care of children can be appealing and very grateful for behavior, but it's not the foundation for a lasting marriage. It really isn't.
Next. Who's left out of all of this?
Beg pardon?
Who's left after all this?
Oh, who's left out of the after all this? The best women.
Yeah.
The women have good moral qualities, who are affectionate, who care about you because of who you are, rather than what you offer. Mm. That's who's left after all this. By the way, although up to 40% of all marriages end in divorce, the other 60% don't. Those are the women you want. The question is, what can you do to make it more likely to pick one of those women and stay with them? Really, in an age of feminist jurisprudence and high divorce rates, I admire the wives who stick with their marriages throughout their lives. It shows that they have a strong moral commitment to marriage and hold to it. Because as you well know, marriage is not all roses. It's got plenty of rough parts. It's a mature attitude in both a husband and a wife that gets through the rough parts and moves on with life. So these choices can be made. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Where do you meet these women? In church or something? Oh, they don't make Aussie girls like that, mate. They just don't.
That's a good idea, and I'm glad you brought it up. Where else can you find a woman who's likely to stay in marriage? If she's religious. And by the way, so are you. She's likely to remain married. A likely faithful wife might be found in a congregation. You should be a member of the congregation, and her parents, and your parents. All of this makes divorce much less likely. And by the way, when you're infatuated with a young woman, introduce her to your friends. Later on, talk to them. Listen to what they say. Introduce her to your parents and family. Afterwards, sit down and talk to them and listen to what they say. If she's recently broken off with another guy, no matter how terrible she says he is, try to get in touch with him and just sit down and have a gentleman-to-gentleman talk. He may learn something. Remember, there are two sides to every story.
Right. Look, I'm sorry to keep returning to this course that you run, but I'm fascinated by it. What was it actually called, and how long did you run it for, at which university, and can you just tell us a bit about it?
Sure. I taught at a college in the city of Montreal. I got interested in this topic, I guess, like late 1980s. When I noticed that feminists were calling men pigs and abusers and rapists, I thought there's something wrong here. And a Canadian woman writer actually summarized it quite well. She said, in the feminist movement, the lunatics have taken over the center. And in fact, they did. And by the way, one of the ways to keep her core of the center is to terrorize young women, to say that men will abuse them, or beat them, or rape them, or threaten their lives. If you scare people, you're well on your way to taking over their lives and directing them in another direction. However, this is important. Throughout the 14 years in which I taught my course, 60% of the students were young women. Young women who had open minds, who had their fill of feminist indoctrination. Some of them made a point of asking, is this another man-bashing course? I said, no, I treat men and women with equal respect. One young woman said, I'm in.
And what was the name of the course?
It was called Men's Lives. And I try to describe the conditions of men's lives in the world right now, mostly in the Western world, and also historically. So that some perspective should be offered on this. Because really, when it comes to sociology, psychology, etc., they are all so indoctrinated with feminism that most people, males and females alike, tend to believe that these stories are true instead of being the result of indoctrination and propaganda.
And how do you see, say, the life of an average working male, you know, either on a farm or in a factory in, say, the 19th century, as to the average male now? What has altered fundamentally about their working lives and their inner lives?
Well, clearly a century ago, both men and women who were on the farm or who were living in the city had to cooperate to maintain the family. Taking care of children required a woman's entire day. As a matter of fact, most of her life well into her late 30s. Work required a man 6 days a week, sometimes seven. The work was exhausting. It didn't pay much. What transformed all this was the industrial society and then the post-industrial society after World War II. When most people in most industrialized countries started earning incomes, and the two things that transformed the condition of women was the contraceptive pill and the ability to have independent income through a job. Once women achieved those two in the Western world, sometime in the 1950s, economically, they didn't need men anymore. And that's what made for the transformation.
So it's really a product of the Industrial Revolution as much as anything else. Is that what you're saying?
Not just the Industrial Revolution, which provided incomes, but the development of the contraceptive pill. That was the transformation. It meant a woman could decide when she was going to have children, or more important, whether she was going to have children. Now, of course, what that produced in the 1960s was the flower generation, in which young men and young women had an awful lot of sex together and enjoyed it a great deal. But women quickly realized that men weren't likely to commit under those conditions. However, it turns out that the ones who really won't commit are women. They're the ones who cause from 2/3 to 80% of all divorces. It's men who are committed to the family. And, of course, once feminist jurisprudence came in, almost guaranteeing a divorcing wife of custody, the home, income, as I said, it takes a woman with high moral qualities to overcome the problems in marriage and stick with it.
We're talking with Jeffrey Asher. He's a leading lecturer in men's issues from Canada. He's had the only men's studies course in Canada for quite some years. We'll be back in a short moment.
This is a tune I usually sing in bars, but you are so beautiful. so beautiful.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Geoffrey Asher. He's a renowned lecturer in men's issues in Canada. Are you there, Geoffrey?
Yes, I am. Please right. Be back with you.
Thank you. Look, I just thought it'd be really helpful because of your academic background. If you could just give us a sort of potted history, really, of how we got here and the origins of feminism. I mean, a lot of people say it dated back to the Bolsheviks and the early days of communism and then the Frankfurt School in the 30s. And, you know, and certainly in the 70s, we were all told to read The Dialectics of Sex by Shulamith Firestone, where, you know, it was all that stuff about, you know, women only enclaves and, you know, any man would corrupt the patriarchy would corrupt any purity of womanhood and so on. So where did it all begin?
Well, certainly for the post-World War II period, it was Betty Friedan, who was a member of the Communist Party, which he kept very quiet. And she developed this theory that women were an oppressed class, like the proletariat. The absurdity of this is that the poorest woman in India or Africa is put in the same oppressed class as Queen Elizabeth II or the wife of Bill Gates, who are the richest women on earth. Separating the world according to male and female is absurd. Now, there is no doubt that this was based on perception that men were doing far better in the world than women. And there's no doubt about that. But for almost all of human history, except for maybe the last 40 years, women's efforts in the home, in the family, in bringing up children, in providing food, in maintaining the family, maintaining the broader family of relationships, maintaining the community, was quite bluntly necessary for human survival. But for the specialized skills of women in community, in family, with children, with the aged, the human race would not have made it. On the other hand, it's men's skills in creativity, in abstract thought, in creating almost all of what is called culture that advanced the human race and gave us domination over the planet. Now, when feminists looked around them at women, they noticed that men seemed to have all the best jobs from their point of view because they were measuring women's lives according to men's lives. A big mistake. Most men, by the way, I will tell you as you know well, are at monotonous, empty, unrewarding jobs, the best part of which is it delivers a salary.
And they absolutely hate them. They feel absolutely enslaved.
Right. Quite right. And why do they do this work for 50 weeks a year, including taking a vacation that they might think better of? It's because they love their wives and children. That's why. Men give up their entire lives for their family, for largely empty work, for pushing pieces of paper around, for taking great hazards with their bodies, with their health, with their lives. Miners do it because they love their wives and children. Lumberjacks do it, men who work in the sea, men who are firefighters. They do this because they are committed to their families and love their families. Now, of course, when feminists said they wanted a part of the best action, they didn't mean the dangerous jobs or the deadly jobs. No, they didn't mean cleaning out sewers. They didn't mean being firefighters, although some attempted it. They didn't have the strength or the agility to do the job. They didn't mean being at the front lines of all the battles. Oh, no, that's certainly not either. No working as police officers except for a tiny minority. They wanted the plum high-paying jobs, usually in the bureaucratic structure. And they felt they were entitled to them and insisted on quotas. But this is another difference between males and females, which I didn't know about until my course was well over in the year 2000. And I wrote a paper on this. It's called Men, Women, and Ability. When you look at the norm in IQ, men score at 100. Women score at 95.5. Now, you might say, a trivial difference. For the most part, it is. But if you add one standard deviation to 115, you find that population is two-thirds male. If you add another standard deviation to 130, which is highly skilled intellectual work, you find that population is close to 90% male. If you add another standard deviation and move it to IQ 145, you find that that population is close to 94% male. If you move it to 160, which is really a brilliance or genius, almost everybody in there is male. It means that of the great achievers over the past 2,500 years, they've been 92% male. That shouldn't be a surprise. And that's not because of any conspiracy. It's because of an inherent male advantage in abstract thought and in conquering nature and creating great achievements. This is something that's generally kept quite quiet because it is so embarrassing. There should be only one criterion for getting the best and most rewarding and demanding jobs, and that should be ability. As I told you last time I was on, a student handed in papers to me. I insisted there be no names on the papers, only student numbers. I wanted to mark every paper blind, and that's exceptionally important for a teacher. Of course, I got the names once I entered the marks in my mark book, but up until then, I didn't know whose paper I was marking. Therefore, woman, man, I don't know, whatever culture, whatever background, when they got a mark from me, they earned it. It was quite that simple. And that's how it should be in the broader world. Those who are rewarded should be rewarded because they have the merit to do the job and deliver that merit in their work, which is why so few women are at the top of the 500 top corporations in the United States or worldwide. The almost entirely men at the very top have to deliver for the corporation. They have to be not merely creative, but insightful and hardworking at the highest level. It's no surprise there are so few women up there.
Despite all these years of positive discrimination and all the rest of it, all the women's business groups that you see around and all of that.
It is not discrimination. It's based on merit. Where do you see an overwhelming proportion of women? Usually in governmental civil service, where women are 60%, two-thirds of all employees. And that's because they're put in there by quotas, which may be part of the problem of why government is so largely unresponsive to the public in dealing with public needs. Because the people in there are chosen by quota rather than ability or commitment to the work.
And how does this impact on... how does this impact on social policy, for instance, certainly surrounding divorce and child welfare and so on and so forth?
A great deal. First of all, most of the social legislation that occurred in the democracy since about 1900 has been largely driven by women. They want the state to protect them. They want the state to protect them in case their husband dies early. And by the way, men have a shorter life expectancy than women throughout the developed Western democracies. In some countries, that gap is quite wide. When I started teaching my course, it was close to 10 years that men died earlier than women in 1990. Now it's down to about 6 years. That's a gap that should not be there. There should be more attention to men's health and to maintaining their health and lessening the dangers they face. Furthermore, once feminists told women they didn't need the family, they wanted the state to intervene and become surrogate daddy. However, that whole drive was utterly mistaken. Among the most fulfilling things for women like men is to have a family and bring up children. Women profoundly need children. I can't prove this, but it certainly is their behavior around the world and throughout history. Women are deeply committed to the family. And by the way, women are deeply committed to their husbands as well, to advance their health, their lives, well unto old age. What keeps mothers and aged husbands alive? It is their wives. It is daughters who take care of mothers unto their old age. It is Mother Nature's gift to the aged. To abandon all that and bring into the state leads to misery in old age and lack of fulfillment for women.
Absolute misery in old age, I should imagine. You certainly see a lot of A lot of women who've had nothing but their careers and they don't
and how empty their lives are at retirement. What are they going to do? Talk to their cats? This is the time when they should have been enjoying their children, their grandchildren, unto their great-grandchildren. In family reunion, they bring in 50 and 60 people. Those doctrinaire feminists now live largely empty lives, talking to each other and probably talking about their embitterment against men as the cause of all of their problems. Men love the women closest to them. They love and admire their parent, their mothers. They want to take care of their daughters. The safest guardian of the virtue of a daughter is her father. I remember once telling my daughter to bring home her new boyfriend when she was about 13. She looked at me and said, "Daddy, you scare them." I thought, good. That's what I'm supposed to do.
Oh, dear. So, how influential were things like the Frankfurt School in the 30s in the whole development up to where we are now?
Honestly, I think this is a decoy. When you look at all the philosophical backing, what that is done is to give some sort of legitimacy to feminist thought. Feminist politics are utterly mistaken. The idea that women are a separate group who are exploited is absurd. It's based on Marxism. The claim that women should be equal to men, not only in the quality of their lives, but in their aspirations, is profoundly mistaken. Women's needs and men's needs are fundamentally different, except they both need to be in a family. And they both need to share in that family, in the care of each other, and in the upbringing of children. What's important to point out about all of this is that it's mistaken. It was mistaken in its Marxist origins. It's mistaken to the present day. We did not get all these millennia of development of human beings so that we could suddenly become isolated and hostile towards each other. That's not what got us here. What got us here is the family, the broader family, the community, and respect and care for each other in the broader social system. That's what we need.
You do see a profound hostility now between the genders, don't you?
Yes, but not everywhere. Remember, about half of all marriages do stay together. Now, not without problems, of course. After all, they're filled with human beings, and society creates problems, etc. But for those who are embittered feminists, and for the young women who are terrified by them, they think their lives and futures are in danger because of this imaginary patriarchy. The patriarchy is no more real than a capitalist conspiracy or other conspiracies based on race or religion or ethnicity. They're really boogeymen made out of air.
Now, we only have about 2 minutes to go, Jeffrey, so would you like to just wind up for us as to the final things you would like to say?
Above all, choose the woman you're going to marry with great caution. Watch out for the pretty young woman who every man is looking at. She's not for you. You want the affectionate woman who will care for you and her children. She will show that affection with her relations, with her father, her brothers, other males in her life, and towards you. You want to know she's the right woman? You should be happy when you are with her. When you're not with her, you should look forward to seeing her again. And when you do meet her again, you should be happy to be with her again. And this should be obvious to your friends, your family, and others. They're the ones who should say, she's the one for you. Because their judgment is probably right. And that's what you should build your future on. And when the problems come, try to find rational and compassionate solutions to them that'll keep you within the marriage.
And if you had to sum up the damage that's been done?
It's appalling. And the sad part is, the children of divorce do not have a model for functioning marriage for their own marriages, which carries it on into the second and third generation and beyond. We must show the children of divorce models of functioning families, models of affection, loyalty, and love, so they can build their futures as well. Children of divorce are frightened of the future for good reason. And that's where a father can provide the strength, the education, the moral values, and the direction into the future that will help build future solid families.
Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. We've been talking with Jeffrey Asher. He's one of the leading commentators on men's issues. We'll be back next week. We'll have Warwick Marsh on. He's best fresh back from the US with a whole lot of material. That should be an interesting show. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for coming on to Dad's on the Air. We really appreciate it. It was a fascinating interview.
Been with you.
No, thank you. Jeffrey Asher from Canada. Really interesting bloke. We'll be back next week.
We're dead.